Let me give you the title of my sermon. It's Families, Good, Better, Best. Families, Good, Better, Best. The first family, the good family, is the physical family. The physical family begins with marriage. Now, marriage is, of course, a divine institution. If we were just animals, and if we had evolved from some blob, then there would never have existed marriage. God bestowed this on humans. Again, it is a divine institution. It comes from God. And He bestowed it on humans alone, not on any part of the animal world. It is His kind of life. It is the family life. Human men did not think out and devise marriage. They did not institute any type of relationship such as marriage. But God did, and He instituted it for the family and for the home life. It was ordained by God, not by man. So because it was ordained by God, and is ordained by God, it is not subject to what men think, and what men want, and what men have come up with recently, all these other aberrations of this divine relationship between a man and a woman. There are many different aberrations, and no telling how far some of these will go, and it's kind of scary to even think of and consider. So marriage, though, is the beginning of this proper relationship. It's the beginning, it's where a family should start. In the family, there are lessons to be learned. There's character to be developed from this correct family structure. A man can learn from his wife, and a wife from the man. For example, when we think of men, men are typically what? Men are typically a specific way. God made men a certain way. And He made women to complement men, and men to complement women. Again, you can fill in the blank, whatever it is. Men, we all know the way we are, typically. We know and we see certain characteristics that run through just what a male is. Men are a certain way, and you see this from the time that they're kids. With Mackenzie and Jenna and Nalan as well, we did not have to make them play with their gender-specific toys. In fact, we just let them play with whatever they want, or develop the things they want, or pick out the things they want. And boys pick out certain things, and girls pick out other things. And it's just the way it is. It's the way that God made us, even though many would like to deny that. And so women know the way that men are, and they see these things, and because women are a different way. And yet, in a relationship, whenever we're with one another, I believe that God has put it together so that we can learn from one another. We can learn to become more the other way, to become more well-rounded, to become more like Christ is. There was a book I read one time. I think the author's name was Armstrong. But he came up with 7 kinds of smart. And so you read through him, you're looking at this kind of smart, and what he goes on to say, and he kind of, I guess, debunks the typical schooling scenario, where when you go to school, you learn about more or less your verbal skills and your math skills. That's mostly what school is about. And he says, well, this kind of leaves some people out. And it does. You know, there are people who are, say, more kinesthetically inclined. But he had another category called interpersonal. There's an interpersonal intelligence. It's the ability to interact with others. And this was really brought home by my wife. My wife, this is over in Australia, got a job with Pepsi. And as typical in Australia, most of the kids graduated around 10th grade. And then from there they went on and did either a journeymanship or an apprenticeship, which is somewhat foreign to us in the U.S., even though we have those terms. But over there, whenever you go into a journeymanship, it's a 4-year degree. You have to do this 4-year stint, and by the time you get finished, you are qualified in that arena. But not everybody goes into a trade. So my wife I think went off more into administrative and secretarial, not necessarily a journeymanship or anything. But later on in life, when we went back and moved back to Australia after living in the U.S. for about 6 years, she went back and started working for Pepsi. And, you know, her strength was not math. Typically, guys tend to be stronger in math. It's one of the things I was talking about. But she started working for Pepsi and started off as a temp and then moved her way up. And before too long, I forget the time span, but it wasn't very long, she had moved up and she was one of the top three women for Pepsi in Australia. And yet all she had was a 10th grade education. So by American terms anyway, this is kind of a foreign concept because you have to have a four-year degree, you have to have a master's, and you have to know business, you have to know all this. But what my wife knew was interpersonal relationships. And this is one thing that I learned from her is that, I mean, the power of, you know, a characteristic that she has and one that she had developed, just how far that is able to take you. And I learned that, and then I started learning, and again, this all under the heading of what do women learn from men and men learn from women. There are all these things that we can get together, and you aren't going to learn this as a guy on your own. I've seen guys on their own. I've seen guys who live by themselves, and they live with other guys. All right? And while this may not be typical of everybody, I'm talking generally, guys will be guys, and girls will be girls. And there gets to be a point where sometimes it's almost a point of no return for some guys whenever they're living in a situation like this. And they also, you see, that they don't develop. There are certain things that are lacking in their development, their growth, and whatnot. So, more or less, whenever we are in a relationship and in this family environment, there is an opportunity for growth. And this is just the physical family. There's this opportunity. And, of course, there's the opportunity for children to learn from their parents. Parents have an obligation, obviously, to teach their children. And initially, and if you look at it from a certain perspective, you as a parent are a god to your child. You take the place of God. As a baby, when you grow up, and you can, you know, follow the analogy along in your own mind, whenever you come into the church, you are a babe, and you need to be handheld. And God invests a greater amount into your life, and you need to be shown the way. But as a parent to a child, they come out of the womb, and they're the most helpless of all beings. They cannot survive like the typical schooling scenario, where when you go to school, you learn about more or less your verbal skills and your math skills. That's mostly what school is about. And he says, well, this kind of leaves some people out. And it does. You know, there are people who are, say, more kinesthetically inclined. But he had another category called interpersonal. There's an interpersonal intelligence. It's the ability to interact with others. And this was really brought home by my wife. My wife, this is over in Australia, got a job with Pepsi. And as typical in Australia, most of the kids graduated around 10th grade. And then from there they went on and did either a journeymanship or an apprenticeship, which is somewhat foreign to us in the U.S., even though we have those terms. But over there, whenever you go into a journeymanship, it's a four-year degree. You have to do this four-year stint, and by the time you get finished, you are qualified in that arena. But not everybody goes into a trade. So my wife, I think, went off more into administrative and secretarial, not necessarily a journeymanship or anything. But later on in life, when we went back and moved back to Australia after living in the U.S. for about 6 years, she went back and started working for Pepsi. And, you know, her strength was not math. Typically, guys tend to be stronger in math. It's one of the things I was talking about. But she started working for Pepsi and started off as a temp and then moved her way up. And before too long, I forget the time span, but it wasn't very long, she had moved up and she was one of the top three women for Pepsi in Australia. And yet all she had was a 10th grade education. So by American terms anyway, this is kind of a foreign concept because you have to have a four-year degree, you have to have a master's, and you have to know business, you have to know all this. But what my wife knew was interpersonal relationships. And this is one thing that I learned from her is that, I mean, the power of, you know, a characteristic that she has and one that she had developed, just how car that is able to take you. And I learned that, and then I start learning, and again, it's all under the heading of what do women learn from men and men learn from women. There are all these things that we can get together, and you aren't going to learn this as a guy on your own. I've seen guys on their own. I've seen guys who live by themselves, and they live with other guys. All right? And while this may not be typical of everybody, I'm talking generally, guys will be guys, and girls will be girls. And I guess to be a point where sometimes it's almost a point of no return for some guys whenever they're living in a situation like this. And they also, you see, that they don't develop. There are certain things that are lacking in their development, their growth, and whatnot. So, more or less, whenever we are in a relationship and in this family environment, there is this opportunity for growth. And this is just the physical family. There's this opportunity. And of course, there's the opportunity for children to learn from their parents. Parents have an obligation, obviously, to teach their children. And initially, and if you look at it from a certain perspective, you as a parent are a god to your child. You take the place of God. As a baby, when you grow up, and you can, you know, follow the analogy along in your own mind, whenever you come into the church, you are a babe, and you need to be handheld. And God invests a greater amount into your life, and you need to be shown the way. But as a parent to a child, they come out of the womb, and they're the most helpless of all beings. They cannot survive like an animal can. The animals, you know, within hours or minutes, they're up on their feet, they're able to move, they're able to evade predators, and they're able to survive. It's not the case for a child. A child must be taught. A child must be cared for from the very beginning until they get to a much later age. So for guys, you know, typically, I think they hit adulthood around 30, so you need to take care of them until then. But little girls are about 6, they're hitting adulthood. So there's always this disparity that you always have to compensate for. And of course, siblings learn from other siblings. And again, let me, you know, I hate to feel that I have to always make justifications or give caveats, but when you're an only child, you don't have the benefit of 2 children. And that's not to say that if you're an only child that you cannot be raised correctly, because obviously God made He made it so that these things could take place, the exceptions to the rule. But for me personally, whenever you look at a child and you see a child, perhaps you've observed only children, and notoriously they're thought of as being spoiled. Because they don't have another child that they have to share with, that they have to get along with. And it's one of the advantages of having other siblings in a relationship, in a family environment. You're able to learn, and you have to learn to share. You have to learn to take care of each other. You have to learn to be patient with the younger one. Sometimes younger ones have to learn to listen to the older ones. So there's always, you know, things to be learned from one sibling to the other. And even as a parent, if you only have one child, you always know who broke the lamp. All right? It's always the one child. If you have 2 children, then you're really a parent, because then you have no idea and you'll never find out. So God thinks that our physical family is very important. The Bible's full of instructions for fathers, for mothers, for husbands, for wives, for children. It's quite explicit regarding all these different roles. For instance, the role of a husband, we see in the Bible that the husband is to be the leader. Again, now I don't have to necessarily make caveats to this audience per se, because we understand that the husband is to be the leader. The world doesn't understand that, and of course, if you're speaking to the whole world, I've seen guys on their own. I've seen guys who live by themselves, and they live with other guys. All right? And while this may not be typical of everybody, I'm talking generally, guys will be guys, and girls will be girls. And I guess to be a point where sometimes it's almost a point of no return for some guys whenever they're living in a situation like this. And they also, you see, that they don't develop. There are certain things that are lacking in their development, their growth, and whatnot. So, more or less, whenever we are in a relationship and in this family environment, there is this opportunity for growth. And this is just the physical family. There's opportunity. And of course, there's the opportunity for children to learn from their parents. Parents have an obligation, obviously, to teach their children. And initially, and if you look at it from a certain perspective, you as a parent are a god to your child. You take the place of God. As a baby, when you grow up, and you can, you know, follow the analogy along in your own mind, whenever you come into the church, you are a babe, and you need to be handheld. And God invests a greater amount into your life, and you need to be shown the way. But as a parent to a child, they come out of the womb, and they're the most helpless of all beings. They cannot survive like an animal can. The animals, you know, within hours or minutes, they're up on their feet, they're able to move, they're able to evade predators, and they're able to survive. It's not the case for a child. A child must be taught. A child must be cared for from the very beginning until they get to a much later age. So for guys, you know, typically, I think they hit adulthood around 30, so you need to take care of them until then, but little girls are about 6, they're hitting adulthood. So there's always this disparity that you always have to compensate for. And of course, siblings learn from other siblings. And again, let me, you know, I hate to feel that I have to always make justifications or give caveats, but when you're an only child, you don't have the benefit of 2 children. And that's not to say that if you're an only child that you cannot be raised correctly, because obviously God made He made it so that these things could take place, the exceptions to the rule. But for me personally, whenever you look at a child and you see a child, perhaps you've observed only children, and notoriously they're thought of as being spoiled, because they don't have another child that they have to share with, that they have to get along with. And it's one of the advantages of having other siblings in a relationship, in a family environment. You're able to learn, and you have to learn to share. You have to learn to take care of each other. You have to learn to be patient with the younger one. Sometimes younger ones have to learn to listen to the older ones. So there's always, you know, things to be learned from one sibling to the other. And even as a parent, if you only have one child, you always know who broke the lamp. All right? It's always the one child. If you have 2 children, then you're really a parent, because then you have no idea and you'll never find out. So God thinks that our physical family is very important. The Bible's full of instructions for fathers, for mothers, for husbands, for wives, for children. It's quite explicit regarding all these different roles. For instance, the role of a husband, we see in the Bible that the husband is to be the leader. Again, now I don't have to necessarily make caveats to this audience per se, because we understand that the husband is to be the leader. The world doesn't understand that, and of course, if you're speaking to the whole world and you have feminists in the crowd, they're going to disagree, and there may even be people who don't even consider themselves feminists who would disagree. But nonetheless, the Bible is explicit that the husband is the leader of the relationship. And if you want to put Ephesians 5:25 in your notes, you can. But it says, husbands, love your wives. And of course, the part that we don't want to forget, especially as men, is that just as Christ also loved the church. So we never forget how we are supposed to love. So husbands are supposed to love their wives. The wife, the role of the wife. Again, it says that in 1 Corinthians 11:3, that the head of a woman is the man. It's very plain, simple, and straightforward. And there comes responsibilities in both parts of this relationship. And there's more instructions in Proverbs 31 on how a woman is supposed to be, how a Christian, godly woman is supposed to be. We have also exemplified in the Bible the role of the parents. Parents are supposed to train up their children in the Lord. Of course, this means something else that goes against the current stream of thinking, and that the children need chastening. And that is the responsibility of a parent, of a loving parent. If they are concerned and if they do love their children, they will chasten them. And in all of this, the whole idea is to turn the hearts of the children to the parents and the hearts of the parents to the children, as Malachi 4 talks about. It talks about, the Bible talks about, the roles and responsibilities of the children. What's the role and responsibility of a child? Well, the fifth commandment next to the 20, obviously, we all know what that is. It says, honor your mother and father, that your days be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you. This is the first commandment. You need to take care of them till then, but little girls are about six, they're hitting adulthood. So there's always this disparity that you always have to compensate for. And of course, siblings learn from other siblings. And again, let me, you know, I hate to feel that I have to always make justifications or give caveats, but when you're an only child, you don't have the benefit of two children. And that's not to say that if you're an only child that you cannot be raised correctly, because obviously God made he made it so that these things could take place, the exceptions to the rule. But for me personally, whenever you look at a child and you see a child, perhaps you've observed only children, and notoriously they're thought of as being spoiled, because they don't have another child that they have to share with, that they have to get along with. And it's one of the advantages of having other siblings in a relationship, in a family environment. You're able to learn, and you have to learn to share. You have to learn to take care of each other. You have to learn to be patient with the younger ones. Sometimes the younger ones have to learn to listen to the older ones. So there's always, you know, things to be learned from one sibling to the other. And even as a parent, if you only have one child, you always know who broke the lamp. All right, it's always the one child. If you have two children, then you're really a parent, because then you have no idea and you'll never find out. So God thinks that our physical family is very important. The Bible's full of instructions for fathers, for mothers, for husbands, for wives, for children. It's quite explicit regarding all these different roles. For instance, the role of a husband. We see in the Bible that the husband is to be the leader. Again, now I don't have to necessarily make caveats to this audience per se, because we understand that the husband is to be the leader. The world doesn't understand that, and of course if you're speaking to the whole world and you have feminists in the crowd, they're going to disagree, and there may even be people who don't even consider themselves feminists who would disagree. But nonetheless, the Bible is explicit that the husband is the leader of the relationship. And if you want to put Ephesians 5:25 in your notes, you can. But it says, husbands, love your wives. And of course, the part that we don't want to forget, especially as men, is that just as Christ also loved the church. So we never forget that how we are supposed to love. So husbands are supposed to love their wife. The wife, the role of the wife. Again, it says that in 1 Corinthians 11:3 that the head of a woman is the man. It's very plain, simple, and straightforward. And there comes responsibilities in both parts of this relationship. And there's more instructions in Proverbs 31 on how a woman is supposed to be, how a Christian, godly woman is supposed to be. We have also exemplified in the Bible the role of the parents. Parents are supposed to train up their children in the Lord. Of course, this means something else that goes against the current stream of thinking is that the children need chastening. And that is the responsibility of a parent, of a loving parent. If they do, if they are concerned and if they do love their children, they will chasten them. And in all of this, the whole idea is to turn the hearts of the children to the parents and the hearts of the parents to the children, as Malachi 4 talks about. It talks about, the Bible talks about, the roles and responsibilities of the children. What's the role and responsibility of a child? Well, the fifth commandment next to the 20, obviously, we all know what that is. It says, honor your mother and father, that your days be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you. This is the first commandment with a promise. It says, if you do this, then I will do this. So we can conclude that if we don't obey our parents, if children do not obey their parents, then it will not go well with you. And also, we see that in Exodus 21, if you want to turn there. Exodus 21, verses 15 and 17. It explains what happened to the disobedient and the disrespectful children. And we need to keep this in mind in terms of, okay, how does God view the role of parent? How serious is he when it comes to what children how they are supposed to treat their parents. In Exodus 21, verse 15 and 17, It says, and he who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. And then 17, he who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Of course, brethren, as we know, we're no longer under the administration of death as it was in the Old Testament times. And it may just as be as well for the children of today. Because if they were, I'm not sure that we'd have an awful lot of children left. Because I look around, physical family is very important. The Bible's full of instructions for fathers, for mothers, for husbands, for wives, for children. It's quite explicit regarding all these different roles. For instance, the role of a husband, we see in the Bible that the husband is to be the leader. Again, now I don't have to necessarily make caveats to this audience per se, because we understand that the husband is to be the leader. The world doesn't understand that, and of course, if you're speaking to the whole world and you have feminists in the crowd, they're going to disagree, and there may even be people who don't even consider themselves feminists who would disagree. But nonetheless, the Bible is explicit that the husband is the leader of the relationship. And if you want to put Ephesians 5:25 in your notes, you can. But it says, husbands, love your wives. And of course, the part that we don't want to forget, especially as men, is that just as Christ also loved the church. So we never forget that how we are supposed to love. So husbands are supposed to love their wife. The wife, the role of the wife. Again, it says that in 1 Corinthians 11:3, that the head of a woman is the man. It's very plain, simple, and straightforward. And there comes responsibilities in both parts of this relationship. And there's more instructions in Proverbs 31 on how a woman is supposed to be, how a Christian, godly woman is supposed to be. We have also exemplified in the Bible the role of the parents. Parents are supposed to train up their children in the Lord. And of course, this means something else that goes against the current stream of thinking, is that the children need chastening. And that is the responsibility of a parent, of a loving parent. If they do if they are concerned and if they do love their children, they will chasten them. And in all of this, the whole idea is to turn the hearts of the children to the parents and the hearts of the parents to the children, as Malachi 4 talks about. The Bible talks about the roles and responsibilities of the children. What's the role and responsibility of a child? Well, the fifth commandment in Exodus 20, obviously, we all know what that is. It says, honor your mother and father, that your days be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you. This is the first commandment with a promise. It says, if you do this, then I will do this. So we can conclude that if we don't obey our parents, if children do not obey their parents, then it will not go well with you. And also, we see that in Exodus 21, if you want to turn there. Exodus 21, verses 15 and 17. It explains what happened to the disobedient and the disrespectful children. And we need to keep this in mind in terms of, okay, how does God view the role of parent? How serious is he when it comes to what children and how they are supposed to treat their parents? In Exodus 21, verse 15 and 17, it says, and he who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. And in 17, he who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Of course, brethren, as we know, we're no longer under the administration of death as it was in the Old Testament times. And it may just as be as well for the children of today. Because if they were, I'm not sure that we'd have an awful lot of children left. Because I look around, and it never ceases to amaze me, the lack of respect, the lack of obedience that children show for their parents. But again, some of that is the parents' fault as well. They're not following and doing their God-given responsibility and their role as parents in raising the children. But nonetheless, this shows the seriousness that God places in this relationship. Children are to respect their parents. In Hebrews 12 and verse 9, Paul says, "Furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us, and we pay them respect." So, by implication, Paul is saying, if you're going to pay respect to your father who is not necessarily in the church, but he's a human father, he's not a godly or divine father, if you're going to pay them respect, how much more should you pay respect to your parents that are in the church, the parents or your father that is in heaven? So again, you go out to eat, you go to the store, you go to somebody's house or a colleague, and you see the child, and you have to be thankful that they live in this day and age than in previous times. Granted, had they lived in previous times, maybe they would have learned the lesson of stoning, seeing a child stoned at the edge of the city. So the problem is that, as an adult or as a parent, you really need to start this before the child is two. And often by then, you see these kids that go two and they get worse and worse, and then you try to deal with them when they're 14, and it's just not going to happen. It's just not going to work. So brethren, we have been given the keys, we've been given the tools, as it were, for what it takes to have a godly. It talks about, the Bible talks about the roles and responsibilities of the children. What's the role and responsibility of a child? Well, the fifth commandment in Exodus 20, obviously, we all know what that is. It says, "Honor your mother and father, that your days be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you." This is the first commandment with a promise. It says, if you do this, then I will do this. So we can conclude that if we don't obey our parents, the children do not obey their parents, then it will not go well with you. And also, we see that in Exodus 21, if you want to turn there. Exodus 21, verses 15 and 17. It explains what happened to the disobedient and the disrespectful children. And we need to keep this in mind in terms of, how does God view the role of parent? How serious is he when it comes to what children and how they are supposed to treat their parents? In Exodus 21, verse 15 and 17, it says, "And he who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death." And in 17, "He who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death." Of course, brethren, as you know, we're no longer under the administration of death as it was in the Old Testament times. And it may just as well for the children of today. Because if they were, I'm not sure that we'd have an awful lot of children left. Because I look around and it never ceases to amaze me the lack of respect, the lack of obedience that children show for their parents. But again, some of that is the parents' fault as well. They're not following and doing their God-given responsibility and their role as parents in raising the children. But nonetheless, this shows the seriousness that God places in this relationship. Children are to respect their parents. In Hebrews 12 and verse 9, Paul says, "Furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us, and we pay them respect." So, by implication, Paul is saying, if you're going to pay respect to your father who is not necessarily in the church, but he's a human father, it's not a godly or divine father, if you're going to pay them respect, how much more should you pay respect to your parents that are in the church, the parents, or your father that is in heaven? So, again, you go out to eat, you go to the store, you go to somebody's house or a colleague, and you see the child, and you have to be thankful that they live in this day and age than in previous times. Granted, had they lived in previous times, maybe they would have learned the lesson of stoning, you know, being a child stoned at the edge of the city. So the problem is that, you know, as an adult or as a parent, you really need to start this before the child is two. And often by then, you know, you see these kids that go two and they get worse and worse, and then you try to deal with them when they're 14, and it's just not going to happen. It's just not going to work. So, brethren, we have been given the keys, we've been given the tools, as it were, for what it takes to have a godly relationship. If we follow the words and the admonitions of the Bible, we can ensure a happy family unit. Again, if you stop and think, happy is such a small, inconsequential, and to me even a generic word. You know, we always use these $15 words to describe things now, and it's supposed to be better, you know, more descriptive. And yet, you just look at a word like happy, what so many people wouldn't give to be in a happy relationship, to have a wife that just, you know, wasn't harping on you all the time, nagging all the time, berating you, not respecting you, or have a husband that was fulfilling his responsibility, or having children that were decent and orderly children. You know, it's a lot that's encompassed in the word happy, that can be encompassed in the word happy. And there's a lot of people out there that I think, you know, they're at a loss for what it takes to have a happy relationship. Yet we have it right here in front of us, and God has given it to us, and all we need to do is to read it, live by it. So the breakdown of 10 and 17, he who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Of course, brethren, as we know, we're no longer under the administration of death as it was in the Old Testament times. And it may just as well for the children of today. Because if they were, I'm not sure that we'd have an awful lot of children left. Because I look around, and it never ceases to amaze me, the lack of respect, the lack of obedience that children show for their parents. But again, some of that is the parents' fault as well. They're not following and doing their God-given responsibility and their role as parents in raising the children. But nonetheless, this shows the seriousness that God places in this relationship. Children are to respect their parents. In Hebrews 12 and verse 9, Paul says, furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. So, by implication, Paul is saying, I mean, if you're going to pay respect to your father who is not necessarily in the church, but he's a human father, he's not a godly or divine father, if you're going to pay them respect, how much more should you pay respect to your parents that are in the church, the parents or your father that is in heaven? So again, it just, you go out to eat, you go to the store, you go to somebody's house or a colleague, and you see the child, and you're just going, you know, it's just, you have to be thankful that they live in this day and age than in previous times. Granted, had they lived in previous times, maybe they would have learned the lesson of stoning, you know, being a child stoned at the edge of the city. So the problem is that, you know, as an adult or as a parent, you really need to start this before the child is two. And often by then, you know, you see these kids that go two and they get worse and worse, and then you try to deal with them when they're 14, and it's just not going to happen. It's just not going to work. So, brethren, we have been given the keys, we've been given the tools, as it were, for what it takes to have a godly relationship. If we follow the words and the admonitions of the Bible, we can ensure a happy family unit. Again, if you stop and think, happy is such a small, inconsequential, and to me even a generic word. You know, we always use these $15 words to describe things now, and it's supposed to be better, you know, more descriptive. And yet, you just look at a word like happy. What so many people wouldn't give to be in a happy relationship, to have a wife that just, you know, wasn't harping on you all the time, nagging all the time, berating you, not respecting you, or have a husband that was fulfilling his responsibility, or having children that were decent and orderly children. You know, it's a lot that's encompassed in the word happy, that can be encompassed in the word happy. And there's a lot of people out there that I think, you know, they're at a loss for what it takes to have a happy relationship. Yet we have it right here in front of us, and God has given it to us, and all we need to do is to read it, live by it. So the breakdown of the family unit can be traced back to, in many cases, of the breakdown of the family, breakdown of society, can be traced back to the breakdown of the family. And many of us, brethren, have not necessarily come from what we would call a nuclear family. You know, a mother, a father, more than one sibling. But nonetheless, you know, we have been called, and we've been called out of that. But a lot of the world still lives in that, and a lot of us have come from that. But that does not mean that we can't live a converted life now. But it can also mean, though, that the rest of our family may not be called. The rest of our physical family, the good family. Just because we're here doesn't mean the rest of our family is here, and doesn't mean that they will ever be necessarily converted. And as we know, and you know, I speak from a certain amount of experience, I know I've spoken to many people who can also speak from experience, that blood, this bond, this family physical bond, only goes so far, and we'll get into that a little more later too. So, brethren, why is it then that God calls whom He does? And why does He place them where He lets them go? Why are they in this church or that church or no church at all? And why does God not always call the whole family that we grew up in? So again, it just, you go out and you go out to eat, you go to the store, you go to somebody's house or a colleague, and you see the child, and he's just going, you know, it's just, you have to be thankful that they live in this day and age than in previous times. Granted, had they lived in previous times, maybe they would have learned the lesson of stoning, you know, seeing a child stoned at the edge of the city. So the problem is that, you know, as an adult or as a parent, you really need to start this before the child is two. And often by then, you know, you see these kids that go to and they get worse and worse, and then you try to deal with them when they're 14, and it's just not going to happen. It's just not going to work. So, brethren, we have been given the keys, we've been given the tools, as it were, for what it takes to have a godly relationship. If we follow the words and the admonitions of the Bible, we can ensure a happy family unit. Again, if you stop and think, happy is such a small, inconsequential, and to me even a generic word. You know, we always use these $15 words to describe things now, and it's supposed to be better, you know, more descriptive. And yet, you just look at a word like happy. What so many people wouldn't give to be in a happy relationship, to have a wife that just, you know, wasn't harping on you all the time, nagging all the time, berating you, not respecting you, or have a husband that was fulfilling his responsibility, or having children that were decent and orderly children. You know, it's a lot that's encompassed in the word happy, that can be encompassed in the word happy. And there's a lot of people out there that I think, you know, they're at a loss for what it takes to have a happy relationship. Yet we have it right here in front of us, and God has given it to us, and all we need to do is to read it, live by it. So the breakdown of the family unit can be traced back to, in many cases, the breakdown of the family, the breakdown of society can be traced back to the breakdown of the family. And many of us, brethren, have not necessarily come from what we would call a nuclear family. You know, a mother, a father, more than one sibling. But nonetheless, we have been called, and we've been called out of that. But a lot of the world still lives in that, and a lot of us have come from that. But that does not mean that we can't live a converted life now. But it can also mean, though, that the rest of our family may not be called. The rest of our physical family, the good family. Just because we're here doesn't mean the rest of our family is here, and doesn't mean that they will ever be necessarily converted. And as we know, and speak from a certain amount of experience, I know I've spoken to many people who can also speak from experience, that blood, this bond, this family physical bond, only goes so far, and we'll get into that a little more later too. So, brethren, why is it then that God calls whom He does? And why does He place them where does He let them go? Why are they in this church or that church or no church at all? And why does God not always call the whole family that we grew up in? There's a whole bunch of different scenarios that we've all either experienced personally or know somebody that's been a part of it where it's just one spouse that comes in. Or the mother with the children, the father stays home, or the father comes and the mother stays home. This is never a good situation. I've seen situations where the child comes and the parents don't go. The child is called. And I say a child, I'm thinking of this one specific person that was called into the church when she was 14, which is quite young to make a move. That's about 8th grade, I guess, in the U.S. to make a move out from your parents and say, okay, I'm going to go to this church. And we know all the tests that come with coming into the Church of God. But, God called her out from her family, from her parents. And so you can have the parents come and the children don't come, depending on the age of the children. So even if within this physical family several are called, it doesn't mean that we're all going to end up at the same place either. Calling is not conversion. Many are called, but few are chosen. We know that scripture. Notice who God calls in Romans 9 and verse 15. How does God make a choice? To have a wife that just wasn't harping on you all the time, nagging all the time, berating you, not respecting you, or have a husband that was fulfilling his responsibility, or having children that were decent and orderly children. It's a lot that's encompassed in the word happy, that can be encompassed in the word happy. And there's a lot of people out there that I think, they're at a loss for what it takes to have a happy relationship. Yet we have it right here in front of us, and God has given it to us, and all we need to do is to read it, live by it. So the breakdown of the family unit can be traced back to, in many cases, the breakdown of the family. Breakdown of society can be traced back to the breakdown of the family. And many of us, brethren, have not necessarily come from what we would call a nuclear family. A mother, a father, more than one sibling. But nonetheless, we have been called, and we've been called out of that. But a lot of the world still lives in that, and a lot of us have come from that. But that does not mean that we can't live a converted life now. But it can also mean, though, that the rest of our family may not be called. The rest of our physical family, the good family. Just because we're here doesn't mean the rest of our family is here, and doesn't mean that they will ever be necessarily converted. And as we know, and speak from a certain amount of experience. I know I've spoken to many people who can also speak from experience, that blood, this bond, this family physical bond, only goes so far, and we'll get into that a little more later too. So, brethren, why is it then that God calls whom He does? And why does He place them where does He let them go? Why are they in this church or that church or no church at all? And why does God not always call the whole family that we grew up in? There's a whole bunch of different scenarios that we've all either experienced personally or know somebody that's been a part of it where it's just one spouse that comes in. Or the mother with the children, the father stays home, or the father comes and the mother stays home. This is never a good situation. I've seen situations where the child comes and the parents don't go. The child is called. And I say a child, I'm thinking of this one specific person that was called into the church when she was 14, which is quite young to make a move. That's about 8th grade, I guess, in the U.S. To make a move out from your parents and say, okay, I am going to go to this church. And we know all the tests that come with coming into the Church of God. But, God called her out from her family, from her parents. And so you can have the parents come and the children don't come, depending on the age of the children. So even if within this physical family several are called, it doesn't mean that we're all going to end up at the same place either. Calling is not conversion. Many are called, but few are chosen. We know that scripture. Notice who God calls in Romans 9 in verse 15. How does God make a choice in whom He is going to call and who He's not going to call? Why is it that some of our members of our physical family are called by God and others are not called? In Romans 9:15, for He says to Moses, I will have mercy on whomever I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whomever I will have compassion. That's it. It's no more specific than that. It's not going to tell you everything, but when you start breaking it down and you look at what is God saying in a situation like this, because sometimes it's merciful to call someone and sometimes it is not merciful to call. God is not going to call somebody that He knows they cannot make it now in this day and age or this era or this time. He would not do that. That is not merciful. That is not compassionate to call somebody who cannot make it. And so He will not do that. He obviously is a sibling, but nonetheless, we have been called and we've been called out of that. But a lot of the world still lives in that, and a lot of us have come from that, but that does not mean that we can't live a converted life now. But it can also mean, though, that the rest of our family may not be called. The rest of our physical family, the good family. Just because we're here doesn't mean the rest of our family is here, and doesn't mean that they will ever be necessarily converted. And as we know, and speak from a certain amount of experience, I know I've spoken to many people who can also speak from experience, that blood, this bond, this family physical bond, only goes so far, and we'll get into that a little more later too. So, brethren, why is it then that God calls whom He does? And why does He place them where does He let them go? Why are they in this church or that church or no church at all? And why does God not always call the whole family that we grew up in? There's a whole bunch of different scenarios that we've all either experienced personally or know somebody that's been a part of it where it's just one spouse that comes in. Or the mother with the children, the father stays home, or the father comes and the mother stays home. This is never a good situation. I've seen situations where the child comes and the parents don't go. The child is called. And I say child, I'm thinking of this one specific person that was called into the church when she was 14, which is quite young to make a move. That's about 8th grade, I guess, in the U.S., to make a move out from your parents and say, okay, I am going to go to this church. And we know all the tests that come with coming into the Church of God. But, you know, God called her out from her family, from her parents. And so you can have the parents come and the children don't come, depending on the age of the children. So even if within this physical family several are called, it doesn't mean that we're all going to end up at the same place either. Calling is not conversion. Many are called, but few are chosen. You know that scripture. Notice who God calls in Romans 9 in verse 15. How does God make a choice in whom he is going to call and who he's not going to call? Why is it that some of our members of our physical family are called by God and others are not called? In Romans 9:15, for he says to Moses, I will have mercy on whomever I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whomever I will have compassion. That's it. It's no more specific than that. I'm not going to tell you everything, but when you start breaking it down and you look at what is God saying in a situation like this, because sometimes it's merciful to call someone and sometimes it is not merciful to call. God is not going to call somebody that he knows they cannot make it now in this day and age or this era or this time. He would not do that. That is not merciful. That is not compassionate to call somebody who cannot make it. And so he will not do that. He obviously has a plan for everybody to be saved at some time, and they will have their chance for salvation. And he'll call somebody out of a situation like that who he knows can make it, even though it might be a hardship on them. He will call them, even though the other spouse is going to end up making their life miserable for a long time. He knows that they can do it. But with these big responsibilities, these big requirements that God then places on us, come big rewards as well. So he does this that he might have mercy on everybody. God knows his reasons for calling or for not calling. And there is a time and place for everyone. So God has not, though, promised that it will go well with us. Matthew 10, let's begin in verse 32. We'll read down to 42. Here's what we do know for those of us that are called. Matthew 10, verse 32. This is Christ speaking. Therefore, whoever confesses me before men, him I will also confess before my Father who is in heaven. Again, it's talking about the parties home. This has never been a situation. I've seen situations where the child comes and the parents don't go. The child is called. And I say a child, I'm thinking of this one specific person that was called into the church when she was 14, which is quite young to make a move. That's about 8th grade, I guess, in the U.S. to make a move out from your parents and say, okay, I'm going to go to this church. And we know all the tests that come with coming into the Church of God. But, you know, God called her out from her family, from her parents. And so you can have the parents come and the children don't come, depending on the age of the children. So even if within this physical family several are called, it doesn't mean that we're all going to end up at the same place either. Calling is not conversion. Many are called, but few are chosen. We know that scripture. Notice who God calls in Romans 9 in verse 15. How does God make a choice in whom he is going to call and who he's not going to call? Why is it that some of our members of our physical family are called by God and others are not called? In Romans 9:15, for he says to Moses, I will have mercy on whomever I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whomever I will have compassion. That's it. It's no more specific than that. I'm not going to tell you everything, but when you start breaking it down and you look at what is God saying in a situation like this, that sometimes it's merciful to call someone and sometimes it is not merciful to call. God is not going to call somebody that he knows they cannot make it now in this day and age or this era or this time. He would not do that. That is not merciful. That is not compassionate to call somebody who cannot make it. And so he will not do that. He obviously has a plan for everybody to be saved at some time, and they will have their chance for salvation. And he'll call somebody out of a situation like that who he knows can make it, even though it might be a hardship on them. He will call them, even though the other spouse is going to end up making their life miserable for a long time. He knows that they can do it. But with these big responsibilities, these big requirements that God then places on us, come big rewards as well. So he does this that he might have mercy on everybody. God knows his reasons for calling or for not calling, and there is a time and place for everyone. So God has not, though, promised that it will go well with us. Matthew 10, let's begin in verse 32, we'll read down to 42. Here's what we do know for those of us that are called. Matthew 10, verse 32. This is Christ speaking. Therefore, whoever confesses me before men, him I will also confess before my Father who is in heaven. Here it is talking about the person who is converted and who lives by God and does not deny God. But verse 33, whoever denies me before men, him will I also deny before my Father who is in heaven. Do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. He's saying that it's not going to be easy for us just because we called, just because he set us apart, and just because we're special in that way, that we have that special calling. It's not necessarily going to be easy. In fact, it's the opposite. He says, for in verse 35, I have come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. How true is this? Are any of us in this situation? Surely we know somebody that is in this situation if we're not. But listen to what he says. And a man's enemies will be those of his own household. These are members of the physical family that we came from. This is the good family. And yet, these are the people